Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, it's understatement to say that media characterizations of the Affordable Care Act vary wildly. But so much analysis is devoted to political football when health insurance is an issue calling out for news people can use. We'll talk about coverage with Adam Gaffney, a physician and writer at theprogressivephysician.org. Also on the show, it wasn't that long ago that many people believed the internet would be a kind of utopia. Today, many still hold that if only everyone had a way to get online, it could be a truly democratic town square. A new book interrogates that idea and shows how, in many ways, the net is anything but revolutionary. It's called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. We'll speak with author Astra Taylor. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
A man with a history of racial hatred, previously jailed for violence in his professed total war on particular ethnic groups and the government, shoots and kills three members of one of the groups he's targeted. Is he a terrorist? Evidently, U.S. media outlets need one more piece of information to make that determination. Is he white? That's the sense one gets from media's treatment of Fraser Glenn Miller, a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan and founder of a militant racist group who killed three people at two Jewish community centers near Kansas City on April 13th. Miller, who had declared total war on Jews, blacks, and the federal government, shouted, "Heil Hitler," after being taken into custody. While Miller's alleged actions seem to fit the conventional legal standard for terrorism, media have so far preferred other language, calling them hate crimes or, on NBC Nightly News, a terrible outburst of violence. This fits a pattern of downplaying acts of right-wing domestic terrorism. The Boston Marathon bombings, which early assumptions linked to Muslims, were labeled terrorism from the start, before any suspects were announced or motives were understood. That contrast alone shows the problem with media's rationale that they only follow the lead of law enforcement in choosing labels. Because calling something terrorism, or pointedly not discussing it in that context, is a political decision. One media exception was CNN's The Lead with Jake Tapper, where Heidi Beerich of the Southern Poverty Law Center asked, quote, "I just wonder, if he had shouted Allahu Akbar instead of Heil Hitler, would he now be facing terrorism charges instead of just hate crime charges?" Close quote. Whatever the law would say in such a case, we're sadly sure we know the choice media would make.
A liberal-leaning Democrat is waging a somewhat lonely but passionate fight against a mega corporate merger. Sounds like the sort of thing you'd see talked about on the liberal-leaning cable channel MSNBC, right? Well, not this time. You see, the politician, Minnesota Senator Al Franken, is the leading congressional opponent of Comcast's $45 billion bid to take over Time Warner Cable. And Comcast is MSNBC's parent company. We noted previously how MSNBC mostly ignored announcement of the merger, with the only substantial exception being the two company CEOs enjoying a kind of victory lap on Morning Joe. Franken's tough questioning of company officials at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing got the attention of the New York Times, for instance, but so far only crickets at the cable channel you'd think might be sympathetic to the views of Franken and the dozens of public interest groups that have spoken out against the deal. CNN, on the other hand, has done much more on the story. They, as it happens, no longer have any corporate ties to Time Warner Cable. So maybe MSNBC doesn't need to tell viewers about the dangers of one mega corporation holding enormous power over cable, broadband, and programming when they're doing such a good job of showing them.
In a USA Today column on April 16th, Fox News liberal Kristen Powers weighed in on the controversy over Brandeis University withdrawing its offer to give an honorary degree to anti-Muslim activist Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Under the headline, "Liberals Attack Female Fighting Misogyny," Powers accuses Brandeis of caving to pressure from the left and dismissing Hirsi Ali's experience as a victim of Islamic cultural misogyny. Quote, But this life experience is no match for the expertise of liberal Westerners who seem to believe the problem is that Hirsi Ali just doesn't know when to keep her mouth shut, close quote. But Hirsi Ali isn't so much a feminist campaigner against misogyny as she is an Islamophobe. She subordinates a good cause to what is centrally a campaign against Islam, which she calls a destructive nihilistic cult of death, which must be eliminated as a religion. She told Reason magazine in 2007 that Islam must be defeated by any means, including military. When asked if she meant specifically radical Islam, she responded, "No, Islam, period." Like her conservative counterparts screaming censorship over the Brandeis case, Powers neglects to mention Hirsi Ali's bigoted or eliminationist remarks, remarks over which Brandeis withdrew its offer to give her an honorary degree. And of course, Brandeis did not silence Hirsi Ali. In fact, it invited her back to speak at the school in another setting. If being denied an honorary degree is an infringement of free speech, then Brandeis is silencing hundreds of millions of us.
Journalist John Meacham is writing a book about George H.W. Bush, who, he says in a recent Time column, is, quote, savoring a favorable shift in the popular view of his own administration's performance while, in classically Bushian fashion, looking forward, close quote. Well, Meacham shows no evidence a rosy reassessment is underway. A November Gallup poll has the elder Bush coming in sixth of 11 modern presidents. The only president more often described as average was Gerald Ford. But it's not just the elder Bush whose political tenure is being reassessed, says Meacham. George W. Bush seems less polarizing, we're told, perhaps due to his paintings that offer the opportunity to consider him in a different, less glaring light. Well, Bush's popularity has increased, but that's much to do with the dismal approval rating he had when he left office in 2009. One poll had him at 22%. Today, Bush is viewed favorably by 49%, but as Gallup noted in USA Today, his recovery is slower than most other ex-presidents, and his approval doesn't cross party lines. And a November Gallup poll had him ninth out of 11 modern presidents. The only ex-president with a higher below-average or poor ranking was Richard Nixon. But Meacham always finds the silver lining when it comes to the Bushes. Quote, Bushes move to new parts of the country. They work hard. They learn from their mistakes, particularly from failed campaigns. And they never, ever give up, close quote. Well, that's what Meacham wrote in Time magazine last year. So while it's not clear that the Bushes are actually enjoying a shift in the public perception of their administrations, they can always bask in the glow of the flattery of journalists like John Meacham.
And finally, if you were producing a news show, you might look at the issues and events of the day and then think about who are the most informed and insightful people you could get to provide analysis on them. But evidently, you'd be doing it backwards. The way some shows appear to work is you decide who you want to interview and then you have them on to talk about whatever. So when the news came out of Ukraine late last Saturday with armed pro-Russian militants seizing several buildings in the eastern city of Slavyansk, Face the Nation didn't look for a regional expert or historian. They just woke up John McCain. Here's Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer kicking off the interview.
And we are joined now by Senator John McCain, who was recently in Ukraine and more recently was sound asleep when we got a hold of him at 6 o'clock this morning and told him about these developments and asked him to join us. Senator, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Bob.
McCain ran through his usual routine. Putin is behind all of this. He's emboldened by Barack Obama's weakness. We should arm Ukrainians to fight the Russians. Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country, and so on. It probably would have been easier to run old tape of McCain from a previous episode. He's far and away the show's most frequent guest. Perhaps because he can be relied upon not to let sleepiness or lack of awareness of events being discussed impede his ability to speak with confidence.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, the Affordable Care Act is going to be a political issue for some time. It may play a large role in the 2014 elections. And there are plenty of stories about that, about how this or that delay or latest enrollment figure might play out politically. But how is Obamacare stacking up for people, for those it's supposed to serve? That seems less clear. Joining us to talk about that is Adam Gaffney, a physician and writer at theprogressivephysician.org. He has recent commentaries in Jacobin and Salon on this very topic. Welcome to Counterspin, Adam Gaffney.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you take in the media about Obamacare, you have Fox and talk radio discussing it as the spawn of Satan, more liberal outlets like MSNBC touting it as a success because of its increasing enrollment figures, and a lot of the rest of the media weighing in for its political impact, how it might affect upcoming congressional elections. What's wrong with that kind of coverage?
I think that the problem with that kind of coverage is that by focusing on the politics of it, the media ignores the actual impact on the lives and the health and the financial well-being of American families and individuals. And it doesn't focus sufficiently on the quality of health insurance. By focusing on the number of people enrolled, we're ignoring a bigger picture about declining quality of health insurance that covers less and less of our health care expenses. Just as an example, the main, the most popular Obamacare plan has an actuarial value of only 70%, meaning that it's only expected to cover 70% of the average family's health care expenses. The rest, the other 30%, will foot in by with copays and deductibles and coinsurance. That's a real problem.
Tell us, in your writing in Jacobin and Salon, you put an emphasis more on the quality of the insurance and, as you say now, the plight of the underinsured.
Right.
Tell us, what does that mean? What is an underinsured person? What are they facing?
Yes. So an underinsured person is essentially facing high out-of-pocket medical expenses throughout a year. And so academically, that often is defined as a certain percentage of income. But I think, you know, a better way to think of it is when people are liable to go bankrupt because of medical bills, when people are being chased by collection agencies over medical bills, or when people have to make decisions between getting health care, seeing a doctor, filling a prescription, or instead other necessities, education, housing, food, that sort of thing. So that's the way I see it. And, you know, I would say that this is not a problem that it was in any way created by Obamacare, but I think it's a problem that is not being stopped by Obamacare. There's been a rise for many years in the out-of-pocket expenses for the insured. There's been a growth in the number of medical bankruptcies. And the interesting thing about medical bankruptcies is that the majority of them are actually among people who have insurance at the time they get sick.
Trudy Lieberman, who has covered the ACA like nobody else, has a piece online at the Columbia Journalism Review that talks about a low-profile action on the part of Democrats and Republicans recently that will make out-of-pocket payments even greater. She talks about people who may get a silver plan. They might be low income. They might be paying $100 or $200 a month, which sounds like a great deal, but then they have a huge deductible, maybe $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 more before they get their first dollar in medical care paid. So they're looking at something like $1,200, $2,400 a year in premiums, plus maybe at least $5,000 in deductible. That's almost, for many people, that's like not having insurance, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And you can see why there are so many bankruptcies, even among the insured. And the piece you're referring to is interesting because it, you know, essentially a bipartisan agreement to eliminate limited deductibles. And, you know, the thing I wrote about in the Salon piece that you mentioned was that there's actually was a major increase in the out-of-pocket limit, which is defined by the law. So, you know, initially there was a out-of-pocket limit of $12,700 annually in out-of-pocket medical expenses after premiums are paid. And while initially that was only supposed to apply to a family of four making, say, greater than $94,000 a year, there was a rule change last year that actually lowered that income threshold to closer to $58,000 of annual income. So what that means is that before your insurance kicks in, as you said, between copays, deductibles, and co-insurance, your out-of-pocket expenses for middle-class or working-class families could be as high as more than $12,000 annually.
Well, that really fits in with what Dr. Steffi Woolhandler of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program said when she was on Counterspin last year. She mentioned that many people will have insurance, technically have it, but won't be able to afford to use it.
Right.
Now, in your Jacobin piece, The Neoliberal Turn in American Healthcare, you suggest that Obamacare is a shift away from universal healthcare. What's the reasoning behind your claim?
The reasoning is that universal coverage is not the same as true universal health care. So first off, you know, we can ask, how does Obamacare fall short of what I would call true universal health care? And I'd say it falls short in two ways. One, in that it doesn't eliminate uninsurance. So although it substantially decreases uninsurance, the projections are that there's still going to be about 30 million uninsured in the years ahead. But even if we put that aside, it doesn't eliminate underinsurance. And in fact, it really sets into law a trend towards higher underinsurance, higher copays, higher deductibles. This is true both of the Obamacare plans and also of the employer health insurance plans, which aren't really affected by the legislation directly. And so it's actually affecting all of us, even though those of us who don't, you know, buy plans on the exchange. It actually even extends beyond both employer insurance and private insurance, even to Medicaid. Some states have gotten a waiver to create a so-called private option to Medicaid expansion. It was kind of viewed as a red state compromise. And for the first time, really, they're going to be, even for people with minimal income, they're going to be having copays and deductibles, or more copays, rather, for those folks. So it's really throughout the spectrum of insurance. It's been going on for a number of years. And the fact is that true universal health care means that you're protected against the cost of illness. And that is not what we see nowadays, either with Obamacare or before it.
I want you to comment on the fact that the media really treat this story as sort of a political football story and not as a story of healthcare and human beings.
Right.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think the media doesn't get into these kinds of details and this kind of personal reporting?
I think that there has been some reporting around that issue, kind of about the cost of care. There's been Elizabeth Rosenthal's report, a little bit about that in a series in the New York Times. But I think that there's always this ongoing assumption, I think both within the media and outside of the media, that cost sharing, like what we're talking about with these out-of-pocket expenses, is absolutely necessary, and that it's just an intrinsic part of our healthcare system, and that without it, healthcare costs would be completely out of control. And we know that's not true, because we know that many other nations actually control healthcare costs better than we do without having that kind of out-of-pocket expenses.
And they have total universal care in the true sense.
Exactly.
We've been speaking with Dr. Adam Gaffney. You can read his latest pieces on Obamacare at Jacobin Magazine, and online at Salon. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Dr. Adam Gaffney.
Thank you so much for having me.
For many years, after every talk a critic gave in any venue about how corporate news media reinforce the social order by marginalizing from conversation those people who are left out of power, the first question of the Q&A was always, but what about the internet? Not as a refutation of the problems that had been noted, but as a way out or around all that. And importantly, a way that's sort of rendered to us by technology without the need for difficult and unpleasant politics. What was the premise of that presumption? What made it easy for thoughtful people to imagine that technology would, in this instance, deliver political or social change? There's a new book about the internet as imagined and as it exists. It's called The People's Platform: Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. It's by writer, filmmaker, and activist Astra Taylor. She joins us now by phone from Phoenix. Welcome to Counterspin, Astra Taylor.
Thanks for having me.
You talk in the book about how the term open that's often used to describe the internet connotes equity and access, a kind of leveling of the playing field between Davids and Goliaths among producers. And the fact that it hasn't played out that way, you explain, is on one level architectural. It's kind of structured into how the internet works. I wonder if you could just explain a bit about power laws and winner take all and how those things impact the democratic potential of the net.
Yeah, there's this idea that the internet is open to everyone, and that does resonate with our personal experience, where we can look at whatever web page we want to and we can comment on things. But the truth is that open doesn't necessarily mean equal. And one thing I look at in the book is the way that old hierarchies have carried over into this new media space, the way that the old media dinosaurs have not gone extinct, but have rather adapted and merged with the new tech giants. And so we're in a brave new world that looks a lot like the old. So these hierarchies come in different forms. And one of them, as you point out, is actually structural. It's infrastructural. It's part of the actual nature of the web. We think of networks as being more democratic, but actually networks aren't necessarily equal. Some hubs have more links than others. And in fact, we see that a small number of sites really dominate the internet. Like, think of a site like Google that we go to every day. And there's a surprising tendency towards monopoly. And that has to do with something called network effects, where the more people who use a service, the more useful that service becomes. So, you know, a telephone system was useful because you could call lots of people with it. And these new sites function in a similar way. Basically, the web tends to break down according to a power law, which is the 80-20 rule. So it's a world where there are a few massive platforms and sites and services, and then tons of infinitesimal little things on the fringe. And that's the model we need to have in our heads as we try to understand the internet. And the thing about this arrangement, this structural inequality, is that it leads then to economic inequality. So these big corporate tech giants are now the biggest companies on Earth. And with that economic power, they can buy up competitors. And we see that. We see them constantly acquiring interesting startups and maintain more and more influence.
Yeah, our friend Bob McChesney used to say that the claim that, well, now everyone can publish is kind of like saying you can write whatever you want on a Post-it note and stick it on your window, and voila, suddenly you're competing with the New York Times, you know.
And it doesn't acknowledge the asymmetry of power that is right there, and the way that actually technologies can exacerbate and magnify those inequities of existing power and not just disrupt them or eliminate them. And we can take pleasure as individuals in our ability to put those Post-it notes wherever we like, but that doesn't mean that we're necessarily empowered.
Well, part of the issue is the declamation, the insistence that the internet, unlike the outer society, is a meritocracy. One primary way that it isn't has to do with the participation of people of color and of women. I know this is the part that's been excerpted in a couple of places, but can you talk a little bit about how gender dynamics in particular are reflected on the web?
Well, there was this fantasy that the web would allow us to all adopt new avatars and identities. You know, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog was an old quote from a New Yorker cartoon that was very popular. The fact is that we're actually bound by our material conditions, and so women have less ability to participate online simply because they tend to take on more responsibilities in the home. So there are these material conditions that trickle up. But online, they are also victims of harassment, and there's been more and more awareness about this issue as women start speaking up. And it's not just anecdotal. There was a study, for example, where some social scientists found that if you use a female username online, you get 25 times as many harassing messages. And that can really shape your experience of online life. And many women have been hounded out of online spaces and declined professional opportunities. And the advice of these academics was, you know, to tell parents, well, maybe encourage your daughters to use a gender-neutral name, which essentially means don't be who you really are online. But the problem is that we, you know, spend our lives online. Online is not separate from real life. You can't just bracket who you are.
Yes, and as you note, then when women are underrepresented for various reasons, that's seen as their choice.
Yeah, and you know, we see this too, and there are these examples of new types of digital collaboration that are held up. Wikipedia is often invoked in very romantic terms, and open source software production, which is the alternative to proprietary software production. But what you see is in these supposedly open communities that women's participation rates are actually just abysmal. They make you nostalgic for the old media world because less than 15% of Wikipedia editors are women. Around 1%, it's estimated, of open source software developers are women. So that's worse than in traditional software development. So we really have to ask ourselves, why is it that these supposedly open networked spaces are actually so hostile to different types of people? The cutting edge can be surprisingly retrograde.
Well, there's no denial in your book that the internet has made communities for people who didn't have them, who's given folks access to things they couldn't see otherwise. You say your book isn't denying the transformative nature of the internet, just recognizing that we've lived with it long enough to ask tough questions.
As I was writing it, I was a bit afraid of coming across as a curmudgeon, and the thing is that I don't feel that way at all. I feel that the problem isn't technology. In fact, we put too much weight on technology to transform our society. The challenge is the underlying economic reality and the business incentives that actually shape the development of so many of our tools. You know, we call these things the new public squares. We call Twitter a public square. We say Google is a library, but actually they are companies that came up in a venture capital-driven model or are publicly traded. And that's actually, to me, the problem. There's a lot of talk of disruption. What we need to do is disrupt the economy. So if we really want to unlock their potential, if we want all of the utopian aspects of them to manifest, all the things we're so excited about having virtual public spaces and having a more democratic culture, then we need to look deeper. We need to look at the underlying funding structures and how that's constraining us and selling us short.
We've been speaking with Astra Taylor. The new book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, is out now from Metropolitan Books. Astra Taylor, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. You can find subscription information on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.